Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to a brand new Arsblog Arscast right here on arsblog.com. I hope you're well. It's been a pretty chilled out week, you have to say, which is fairly inevitable after the way the football went last weekend. Not much to say, is there, after a 5-0 win? Achieved without your best player so far of the season, with five different goal scorers and your fourth clean sheet in five games? What can you do but go full Oliver Twist and say, "Please, sir, can I have some more?" And by some more, I mean do that in every game between now and the end of May. And I think we'll all be pretty happy. Of course, there will be some people who will complain. That's just the nature of some people. But in general, if we could just, you know, keep winning and stick with the not losing thing, I'd be all right with that. It has been a pretty uneventful week, so we've got to do something a little bit different with this week's podcast. It's going to feature an interview with a man who joined Arsenal in the 70s, made his debut in 1979, played over 160 games for the club, unfortunately had to retire quite early. But we get the story of John Devine, who was spotted by Arsenal scouts in Ireland, went on trial, joined Arsenal in the 70s, grew up with the likes of David O'Leary, Frank Stapleton, Liam Brady, among all the other Irish guys that were there at the time. So we get the story of how that came to happen. How was he spotted in Dublin? How did he make the move to Arsenal? What was it like? How the club helped him? How the club treated him during his career? And why it ended so early? And, of course, we touch on what he's doing now and his thoughts on the current modern Arsenal. So that's all going to come between now and the end of the show. As well as that, of course, we do have to look ahead to the North London Derby taking place tomorrow, so we'll do that a bit later on. But apart from that, it's been pretty quiet this week. There's been not much happening, and that is the consequence of things going well, and I'm quite all right with that. When a Jack Wilshere smoking story again is the biggest issue of the week leading up to a North London Derby, then you know that things are pretty all right behind the scenes. There's no drama, there's no crisis, we're not firefighting after a defeat or a bad performance. We've been playing well, the results have been reflected in that, and we're in good shape going to White Hart Lane tomorrow. As for Jack, well, it's a bit daft, isn't it? I know it's not the worst thing in the world, but maybe, just maybe, when you know you're going to get your picture taken on a night out with your mates and all the girls and stuff, just put down the pipe thing. Put down the pipe before somebody uploads it to Instagram or one of those. Just put it down. That way nobody would ever know what it was you were doing. The things that happen off camera, nobody knows about. Now, maybe it was because he was in a circle of friends that he thought he could trust what was going on. But look, you know what young people are like today. They upload everything. Every single bit of their lives. You can get it on Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat and all those kind of things. Those of us of a certain vintage are a bit more reluctant to share everything. Every single tiny little minuscule insignificant thing that we do. But that's not the case for these kids today. You know how it is. So a little bit foolish of him. It's not the first time either, is it, that he's been caught smoking? You remember that he was caught during the summer standing in a swimming pool with a cigarette. Now that I think about it, Wojciech Szczęsny was smoking in the showers. So maybe there's some method to their madness, because we know that Szczęsny and Wilshere, they're great friends. Maybe they're planning for the future. Football is a volatile career. You're up one day, down the next. Who knows when it might end? It's not like these guys have a trade to fall back on. Not like the old days, where you could go work for the local shipbuilding yard when you were finished. It's not the case anymore. Maybe they're trying to create the first waterproof cigarette. I mean, we've got electronic cigarettes now. We've got flavoured cigarettes. We've got colouredy ones. We've got filtered and unfiltered. They could be just taking it to the next level.
Perhaps they should do their research at home, though, not in public. That would be the best thing for the future. The other thing I've had to deal with this week is a second Andrew Mangan. I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but there's an Andrew Mangan in Colorado, in the United States of America. I think that's where he is, because I keep getting signed up to political events by some candidate for, I don't know whether he's Democrat or Republican or whatever he is. All I know is I'm not interested. And I keep getting these emails from people saying, thank you for applying to be on our course, blah, blah, blah. And I reply, look, this is not the right guy. This is a completely different Andrew Mangan. And they sometimes don't write back. But sometimes I say, oh, thank you. We'll try and figure out what's going on with Colorado Andrew Mangan. But now there's another one. Another one. And he's worse. This guy's in Melbourne, Australia, and Andrew Mangan in Melbourne, Australia. And the problem is they're giving out my email address, or at the very least, I'm getting emails that are supposed to be for them to my email address. I don't quite know what it is. I know there's some issue with Gmail, whereby if you have like your first name dot last name as the email address, it will go to the person who's got first name, last name without the dot. There was something like that, I remember, in the past. But this week I got an email from a lady called Pam, who said, hi, Andrew, welcome aboard. We spoke briefly on Sunday. I coach the championship team and look forward to working with you. Then she says, if a player needs to be strapped, are you able to do this before their game? Well, now, I'm assuming this is something to do with physiotherapy. But what if this is a weird torture that's going on? That this Andrew Mangan in Melbourne, Australia, is strapping players of some sport down, and this Pam woman is electrocuting their genitals? Or putting her finger in places that her fingers should not go? So I'm concerned that my reputation as an Andrew Mangan is being besmirched by these other Andrew Mangans who, if we're being perfectly honest here, don't do the brand a great service. Like, if they can't figure out what their own email addresses are, what hope is there? So I write back to this Pam woman and say, look, got completely the wrong Andrew Mangan here. I'm not going to strap anyone to anything. Maybe you could phone up this other Andrew Mangan and just tell him to use his own email address in the future. Nothing. I haven't heard anything. Now I'm concerned. I'm part of a strapping torture network that stretches across the globe. Could be a knock at my door any minute. It could be the FBI, CIA, rendition. Who knows? All because these guys can't figure out their own email address. Not right and proper. So if anyone knows these other Andrew Mangans, could you please perhaps punch them in the testicles? Or just tell them to figure out what fucking email address they're giving out to strange ladies who put their fingers in athletes. Thanks. Glad we got that cleared up. Right. Here's what we're going to do. Later on, we'll touch on the North London Derby. We'll get all the team news. Who's in? Who's out? Who's going to be available? What is the selection dilemma the manager faces ahead of this game away at White Hart Lane? But now, we're going to talk to John Devine. Sometimes it's a little bit odd when you meet somebody whose sticker you collected all those years ago, but it was an absolute gentleman, and it was great to talk to him about his life as a footballer, his life at Arsenal and beyond. So let's do it. Let's talk to John Devine. All right, so let's start by where, what part of Dublin did you grow up in?
Church Street. Inner city, in the middle of town. And I played for a local team there in Halton Street Community Centre, and it was St. Mickens Boys. And I played there from 9 to 12 years of age under the manager Joe Lawler and my father Pop Devine.
Pop Devine,
he was a goalkeeper, he was good.
Any issues there with your dad being the part of the coaching setup?
No, well, he wasn't necessarily there at all the games. He was very way ahead of it. He played the game and he realised the pressure of putting kids under pressure early on was not on. The most advice he gave me, which is priceless, was to practice with both feet.
Right.
And that stood to me in time as I played for Arsenal in the cup final years later. So he wasn't really hands-on all the time. He would just help out occasionally. Joe was the main man, the manager, yeah.
Right, okay. And so you would play just all around the city?
We play on the streets, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. You come home from school, you throw your bag in the bin. Yeah. Out you go, get your coats down.
Forget the homework.
Forget the homework. Come back to that later. And you'd spend 2 or 3 hours practicing, and then playing 1v1, 2v2, 3v3 on the streets.
Three and in.
And that's it. And you were out on the street all day long.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where you got your contact with the ball.
Right. And at what point then did it become sort of more formal, like joining, at what age, about 12?
Yeah, exactly 12. About 12, I started to cause a few ripples with people around different leagues. And, you know, you had your premier teams, you had Home Farm, you had lots of teams like that that were very renowned for developing young players and gaining international status at under 15.
Yeah.
So there was lots of temptations to leave my local club. But I stuck with them then until under 13, and I went out to another club, a lesser type of club, in St. John Bosco.
Oh, yeah.
Out in Drimna.
Yeah.
And
that's where my dad grew up, actually.
There
you
go. And exactly, and a great club. And I was pleased I went there because it gave me a chance to develop as a defender. We were always fighting and scrapping.
Yeah.
So it taught me how to defend.
Literally?
Literally, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So John Bosco was my choice. I didn't go to Home Farm, much to my father's. You know, he really was worried about that because he said, look, if you want opportunities to ever play for Ireland under 15, they're the type of opportunities you're going to get.
That was the big one, wasn't it? Home Farm was where everybody went. Yeah.
Yeah, it produced the majority of young Irish international players. Mm. But I went training with John Bosco in Drimna, and I loved the atmosphere. I loved the players around me. We had a great time. And I used to get 2 buses to training.
Yeah,
so instead of just walking up the road to Whitehall from where I lived, I got 2 buses. So it was a big sacrifice, but well worth it.
Yeah.
Yeah, enjoyable.
Okay, so when did you then come on to the radar of Arsenal and maybe other football clubs? Or were you aware that people were watching you? Or how does that work? Because
well,
13,
most,
14,
most of
15.
The clubs, most of the big clubs at the time, for instance, Man United, Liverpool, Everton and Arsenal, they were the 4 big ones, would have scouts here in Dublin.
Yeah.
Because they knew the majority of the best players would have been 80, 90% would be in the Dublin leagues. And in the Dublin leagues, they would have been mainly with Home Farm and players like that, Stella Maris, Belvedere, these top teams.
Yeah, yeah.
But what happened was they had trials for the under 15 international squad, and I went to the trials, and you just elimination process constantly. There was about 300 kids. And people started to recognise as well. I'd been chased by Home Farm for a couple of seasons. Mm. And you get that recognition. And then Bill Darby came. And that was the start of it, really. Bill Darby came to the house and spoke to my parents.
And what was that process like? Was that like we want to take him or we're interested? Or
yeah, well, what it was, he did recommend again that you possibly, you know, the higher clubs would have more opportunity to play for Ireland. But luckily for me, fortunately, I passed the tests and I got into the squad with the Irish team, and Bill would have been keeping an eye on me a lot over that 6 months. And when he came to the house, he actually asked them would they be interested in allowing me to go on trial to Arsenal. So I had got my first couple of caps as friendlies and stuff like that and training sessions, and he would have been on the doorstep asking my parents to let me go. Now, I didn't know anything about this, by the way. For about a year, my parents told me later that Bill and which I thought was very fair of them, you know, not to disappoint me, that if they weren't allowed to go, if I wasn't allowed to go. So Bill would have secretly spoke to my parents, and they were worried about my schooling.
Yeah, of course.
If I knew I was going to Arsenal, I'd just lay back on the school. So they're very clever to treat
them. And would you have?
Of course. Football, you have to cut the corners. So it was fantastic that they got away with that. I went over then, and then Bill got me over then. I was only 13 and a half when I first went with Dave O'Leary, yeah. So it was amazing.
The two of you went over together?
Yeah, Dave would have been over before me.
Yeah.
Because Liam, Frank and Dave, which we'll talk about later, obviously, they were two years older than me. And but on that occasion, it was good to travel with somebody.
Yeah.
And he happened to be going back at that time. And I remember my first trip on a plane and with Dave. It's like yesterday. It was fantastic. And I had a good week. I did okay. And that was one of several trial situations at Easter and summertime and Christmas when there was breaks.
Right.
You go over on trial.
So what exactly would happen for you? What age were you, 13 and a half?
I was 13 and a half.
So what happens
trip
when you go on trial? What's expected of you, and what do you have to do? Do they watch you in training? Do you play match?
I mean, you're in the same position. And what you realise very quickly is that you're with all your talent that you have here at home, you're a big fish. When you go there, you realise immediately the ball was kicked off you were in for a hell of a time, because everybody that was there was selected as the best of where they came from, whether it be Leeds, Manchester, Wales, Scotland, Ireland. Sure. So you immediately knew the first morning's training, this is going to be tough. They were all good players and quality players and all wanted the same thing badly. So you'd go into a digs, that they'd have families, like with probably boys and girls in the family to make you feel at home. You get you settled in, and then you'd go to training on the bus, and you'd go mainly into practices like grids, 5v2s, possession play, and then mainly games.
Right.
And they were just looking to see, and you were eliminated. It'd be three or four pitches going at the same time. You know, that elimination process was ruthless.
Yeah.
And that wasn't just Arsenal, that was everywhere. Because I did go on trial to Everton and a few other clubs, and I was supposed to go to Man United later on as well. And it's a very ruthless business. It's cutthroat.
Yeah.
And you learn very quickly what you're in for.
Yeah, I think people nowadays would assume it's like that. But even back then, I'd say there was less inclination to be, not decent, but, you know, to make it easy for kids.
Absolutely. I think people are far more educated now as regards to the welfare of child protection, and child welfare is a big issue now over the last 20 years. That wasn't there. But I have to say one thing on Arsenal's behalf. Every time I ever went there, I was treated fantastic.
Yeah.
The staff, Fred Street, all the people in the Alf Fields, there were so many great people there that had gone through the system with Bertie Mead, the manager. And I only realised that when I got a little bit wiser and older, that these are fantastic people helping the club, putting some back in.
That was kind of the exception rather than the norm for football clubs.
Absolutely, because some of the kids that would have come from other clubs had said they couldn't believe it, they weren't treated well, they were just thrown back in the digs, and a phone call to say, you're not being asked back, end of story.
Right.
Arsenal were fantastic. From start to finish, my whole career, I can't say enough about them. Yeah. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
So how long did it take for Arsenal to become convinced enough by you to bring you on board?
I think
properly?
After about 6 months, I'd been about three or four times over that 6 to 8 month period of that, up to 14 and a half.
Yeah.
And then I was playing Irish under 15 international. I'd gained a few caps. And they obviously had seen enough to see potential there, which is all it is at that age.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, that process of just picking maybe 10, 11, 12 apprentices each year, straight away you realise of that 300 over that year, that 10 are going to be the ones. And then of that 10, 2 years later, you might pick one pro. So it's a ruthless, very intensely pressurised situation for a young kid.
It's very difficult, isn't it?
Very tough. People don't realise. See, what happens a lot in Ireland as well, there's a lot of kids being put under pressure in games here, highly competitive games, to win leagues at under 11, 12 in Turkey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's too much for the kids to take on board. And they're just not prepared for what's happening over there. We need to get back to the technical side of it.
Yeah.
And we have a better chance of survival then, you know.
Right. Okay, so after three or four trials, I mean, it must be exciting and stomach-churning, and this opportunity is sort of within reach.
Absolutely.
And you're... Yeah, I mean, how did that affect you generally day to day? I mean, when you were playing back here, did it improve you as a player going over and back when you were coming back here?
Absolutely. I mean, there was one issue I remember very, very clearly. 1971 FA Cup final.
Yeah.
And it was incredible. I just happened to be in the house. We have a big group in our family. There was 12 always in the house at any given time.
Yeah.
And for some strange reason, I found myself on my own watching the 1971 Cup final. And Charlie George, when he scored that goal, like I said, you know, as a dream, you say, I want to play there. Every kid does.
Yeah,
every kid wants to. But I got that dream 2 years later. And it was something I always wanted to do. So you can imagine how disappointing it must be for the majority.
Yeah.
So I was one of the fortunate ones that on that day I get called in.
Yeah.
And for that 6 months before my junior cert, my school was affected. There's no doubt about it. I was wondering, am I going to sign? Am I not going to sign? And then when you hear that news, it's just like... It's the best feeling in the world. It's incredible.
So what happened? Was it a phone call or someone came to the house?
No, I was in the house. I come in and my parents, my father, Papa and Eileen, my parents called me, sat me down and said, listen, we've got good news for you. Arsenal have been on. Bill Darby's been down to the house and they want you to sign a contract as an apprentice. And the school bag definitely went in.
And stayed there.
Yeah, so it was fantastic. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Fantastic. A dream come true. There you are. And if you think about it, years later, I'm there at, you know, 12 years of age, you know, watching the 71 FA Cup final, and 7 or 8 years later you're playing in it. It's just phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's just
hard
beyond,
to get your head around. Yeah.
It's hard to get your head around it. But again, one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. So what, you were 15 and a half when you
I was 15? 15 and a half. I went over 15 then and signed the contract here at home in the house, and then again you signed another piece of paper over there, and then you get ready for the move across. They set you in digs, and that's the first step on the run. And then the homesickness can kick in. So now the real work starts.
Yeah.
All the furore of saying you're going to sign, you're going to play, you think you're going to make it, and you see people pushed by the wayside day in and day out. So you go to the digs, and then it's a key element. The first 3 or 4 weeks, like a honeymoon period, everything's great. You're training, you're used to, you're not used to training every day, which is a big... That's a big sudden change and a big impact on young players. It can break a lot of people because you're actually training every day.
Yeah.
And sometimes twice a day, and then you're doing lots of chores. In those days, the apprentices had to work,
clean the showers, clean the toilets, clean the boots,
we'd get the kit ready for the first team and the reserve. So it was a tough business. You had to get up early in the morning and get your work done, then train, and then get the work done again for the kit. But it was a discipline, I think, came from the top with Bertie Mee. So Bertie Mee, he was an ex-RAF, as you know, physiotherapist. And most of the staff were Fred Street, the physio. He was a RAF guy as well. So they were very disciplined army people. And if you couldn't cut it, you were gone.
Yeah.
You know, so
did that help in a way? Because you knew exactly what was expected. Because, you know, if there's discipline, if there's rules and regulations you have to follow, then, you know, if you fall inside that, then it makes sense.
It suited my mentality. I was very lucky because, as I said, when you grow up in a house, my mother and father were 12 people, there's a discipline and there's a set pattern of everything, how things are done.
Yeah.
And that stood to me when I went over, and it suited me down to the ground.
Any homesickness at all? Was it difficult to transition from Dublin to London? Whereabouts were the digs?
The digs were in Southgate, North London, yeah. And the majority of the digs, the lads would have all been within a 2 mile radius so they could meet or go around and talk to each other. But there, obviously everybody, I think, suffered from that initially, because if you remember back then, you probably only had 2 stations on the television.
Yeah.
It wasn't like digitalized.
Yeah.
We barely flew. People had never flown before.
And it was expensive back then to fly.
It was over £120 back then to fly across to London in those days in the 70s. So it was just a case of you were in the digs, you trained, you got home at 6 o'clock, you had your dinner, and by 10 o'clock you were in bed.
Yeah.
So it was really, you felt lonely at nights a lot of the time, but it's what you wanted to do. So I think everybody suffered, but they were very good again. Arsenal, fantastic. Every 6 weeks for the first 6 months, you know, they'd send you home. And if you really needed a thing, if you're really under pressure, they'd get you a flight home. They were fantastic.
Wow.
Absolutely fantastic. And again, that would not have happened anywhere else, really.
That's kind of behind the scenes stuff as well, isn't it? That people don't necessarily think about, you know?
No, they don't. They don't imagine a child playing on the street at 12 and 13 and 2 years later being living in London.
Yeah.
It's a huge transition, especially catching your first flight, you know, going to meet new people, living with a new family, where you're used to having lots of family, brothers and sisters around.
Yeah.
So it's a big transition, and some can handle it and some can't. So luckily for me, I had a couple of periods in the first 6 or 8 months, and then the coaches made it very clear, listen, you're here to play football now, you've got to make sure. So they give you that first year,
yeah,
and then it becomes a bit more
intense.
You've
got to toughen up a bit.
But
yeah.
Arsenal were superb in that category.
And what was the footballing education like? Because I don't know if the coaching that you would have got here compared in any way to what happened at Arsenal.
No, with the greatest respect to Joe Lawler and all the coaches in Ireland, they would have only been filtering down bits of information that they got from England anyway, in a lesser scale. So for me to train every day was a dream. I was doing that on the streets every day anyway here, but to have it structured and to be getting the proper information from top coaches that knew the game inside, ex-players, and giving you tips, it was just a dream for me. Yeah. I love that. So the coaching was excellent.
Yeah. And obviously in the 1970s there was a very strong Irish connection at Arsenal.
Absolutely.
You know, because I grew up in England in the 70s. My folks are both Irish, and I'm pretty sure that's what made me an Arsenal fan, that and Liam Brady. But the fact that there were Irish players, O'Leary, Stapleton, Brady, yourself, and all the Northern Irish guys as well at that point, I mean, there was no distinction in my mind between the two. So you had Sammy Nelson, Pat Rice, Pat Jennings. Was that a big help?
Absolutely. That was the deciding factor for me signing for Arsenal, because I'd been offered to go to Man United. And the way it worked was they try and get you on trials in the summer period because you had 6 or 8 weeks off. So I had been booked to go to Wolves, who were a Premier team at the time, and Everton, top team with Alan Ball, Howard Kendall, all these guys, top players, Arsenal, and then Man United. But when I walked through the doors of Arsenal and I heard Liam and Frank and Dave, I heard the voices, and Tony Donnelly was the kit man, and his wife, that was it. I just felt at home. I felt, but when I, walking through the marble halls anyway has an effect on any child. I mean, I was 14 years of age, and you walk through this fantastic place, and you're made feel welcome. And everything about the training pitches, the facilities compared to anywhere else. Mm. So I literally come back home off the plane and said, "Dad, I'm signing for Arsenal."
Yeah.
If that was the choice. And that was it. And it did have an influence, yeah.
Do you remember your debut?
For Arsenal?
Yeah.
I do indeed. Leeds United, 22nd of May, 1979.
Right.
3-1, we won. Great game. I mean, you don't forget those things. It was fantastic. And the lads were brilliant to me again, the older guys, when you get into the team.
Yeah.
I'd had a bad injury a year earlier. I had a cruciate ligament and in the reserves at Southampton. And that was a career-threatening injury.
That's right, yeah.
Days.
Back then, that could have been really bad, couldn't it?
I can only give credit to Fred Street. What a fantastic man he was. The minute I got back off the train from Southampton, he had me going down to his doctors, had me on x-rays immediately and got me operated on within 4 days.
Right.
So, again, he told me that your career was finished. So to be back a year or 14 months later...
You were told that, were you? Or?
Well, yeah. It was, in fact, the two people that we went together in a car was Malcolm McDonald, who was having a problem with his knee at the time, and myself. And when we came out of the surgery, Malcolm immediately said, "How did it go, kid?" I said, "It doesn't look good." He said, "But he has this new carbon fiber stuff that they're trying to work with, so they're experimenting with, so they're going to try a few different things for me to see if it works." And touch wood, a year and a half later, I was playing the FA Cup final.
Wow.
So it was a fantastic recovery. And Fred said, "You were very strong and fit at the time. It was in an area that we could have helped you with it." So it just happened to work out because of the treatment and because I was at Arsenal. Had I been anywhere else, I don't believe I would have played.
Wow.
It was because of Fred Street and the staff at Arsenal and how they treated me at the time. They got me instant attention. They got me straight away down to the top people, and I was operated on immediately, and the recovery process took place, and I put that all down to Fred Street. So I have a lot to thank him for in my career.
Yeah, right place, right time, kind of, if you're going to have that kind of an injury. Because I remember even when, was it before the 1990 World Cup, Niall Quinn had that injury, and people were... This could be a career ender, you know, and that's 1990.
Well, even these days now, I know they can the fantastic surgery, but when, you know, people break their legs, which I've broken my leg a couple of times as well. I was unfortunate like that. But the cruciate ligament was one that it was thought that was it.
Mm.
You were finished. So again, as I say, I was blessed. I came back and got through it. And that was probably the lowest point in my career.
Right.
And then getting back to the highest point was 14 months later through hard work and... dedication with great people. I walked out at Ellen Road in front of Leeds, and I never forget Arthur Graham was with the winger, and he went off at half time to nurse his bruises. And I said, the worst thing I ever did in my life was do that, because Alan Clark came on in the second half, and we all know what he was like.
Yeah.
But they were sort of coming to the end of their careers at that stage, the last of the Revy era. But for me, again, think about it, you're 14 years of age, you're watching these guys on television, Johnny Giles, Jack Charlton, all these top players, Norman Hunter, bite your legs, Alan Clark, all these guys, and now you're playing against them. It's just
what was your approach then, you know, as a young guy going into the Arsenal first team, going up against Leeds, who still had that kind of prestige because of what they'd been doing in the 1970s? I mean, were you a physical player? Did you like the physical side of the game?
I think I was more of a ball player.
Yeah.
To be honest, I wasn't a toughie, like making tackles to beat the band. As far as I could say, I was very fortunate for my father, Pop, again, rest his soul. He told me, practice with both feet. When you go to England, they'll all be able to do this. And it stood to me that I've got 7 or 8 caps playing left back for Ireland as well as right back. So growing up then into the U team and the reserves, you very quickly realise... you're here for a purpose. You see people getting pushed out the door at every club, so you become hardened, and you either want to make it or you don't. So that respect is there, but not enough to alter your winning mentality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Now, you showed me some team sheets before we started talking from the reserves, and you're playing centre half alongside David O'Leary, but you played most of your stuff at fullback. When did that transition occur, or was that a choice? I mean, when you were a young player, were you playing centre half?
Centre back all the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it was only when I went there after about, you asked me when, it was about 6 months into the Arsenal situation, and I was playing alongside Dave O'Leary. And again, you can be fortunate that there can be a glut of players in your position, and there can be some weaknesses in other positions in the U teams and the reserves. So there happened to be a few slots in the U team at right back, and the coaches tried me there, and I loved it. I was able to go forward a little bit more. More freedom to express instead of defending all the time.
It's harder work, though. I played centre-half all my life, and I like the fact that you don't have to get up and down the wing.
Yeah, it's hard work carrying Dave O'Leary as well. You know?
Oh, well, yeah. It's a tough job for anyone, isn't it?
No, so it was great. I mean, I got on great with Dave, and we were in digs together. 48 Roundhill Drive, Mrs. Lewis. Never forget it. Southgate.
Tired of ads interfering with your favourite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's a brand new year, and what better time to get going with that online store you've been thinking of? Those "I was there when Arsenal actually scored a goal" t-shirts would fly off the shelves right now. And to get yourself up and running, you need Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way through to the did we hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms, and sell more with less effort with thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 a month trial period at shopify.com/arsblog, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/arsblog now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/arsblog.
And we lived there for a couple of years together. Dave would be pruning his nails and getting ready for the glory, and I'd be listening to the Carpenters on the radio. You know, I loved my music. Dave was ready made to be captain of Arsenal, let me believe you.
Yeah.
He was brilliant from the start. He just had that presence about him. He had that thing about Dave when he walked in the room, boom. He had that. You knew he was going to be a top player.
Sort of like a quiet leadership, because you get some guys who are obviously very vocal and that kind of a leader.
Yeah. But Dave led by example. I mean, there was very few people beat Dave in any game. He was so quick, and he read the game well, and he was brave. He just had that quiet, you know, distinction about.
And he lasted a long time as well,
didn't
he?
He was fantastic.
Because not easy to keep up that level.
Over 700, nearly 800 games for Arsenal. It's phenomenal. Fantastic, you know. Fantastic career.
So can you remember the first time you played at Highbury? And what's, you know, I can remember the first time I ever walked into Highbury and saw the pitch and the green and, you know, well, most of it was green, but, you know, and it's amazing. But what's it like to run out there as a player?
Well, I have to mention one person. Fred, the groundsman at the time, used to smoke a pipe. And if he seen anybody walking on the pitch, he had a shotgun, he'd do you. So nobody was allowed on the pitch for two reasons. You had to be good enough, or Fred was out in the lurches watching out for you. But I remember it was an FA Youth Cup game.
Right.
And it was phenomenal. And again, the fans would be there. There'd be a couple of thousand people watching the games because they wanted to see what was coming through. The young lads, great support. And just walking down that tunnel is just magical. And it was an incredible feeling, fantastic.
It was a brilliant stadium, wasn't it? Or it was a brilliant...
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, it was great.
So the FA Cup final that you've spoken about, the 1980 FA Cup final, surely very mixed feelings about it because of the occasion, obviously, to be going out there and against a team at the time, West Ham, who were in the second division. And I can remember it very well because 79 was the first time I remember football and watching Arsenal and being... very obviously overjoyed by the fact that we'd won the cup, despite how frightening it was towards the end of that game. You know, we're 2-0 up. I'm not thinking this is brilliant. This is what it's like all the time. Yeah. And then they come back, and you're like, oh shit! And then we score, and it's brilliant. And then the following season, there was obviously the Cup Winners' Cup final and the 1980 FA Cup final. So to play that game at Wembley and to be walking out, you know, in an Arsenal shirt, and then for the game to go the way that it did.
Yeah.
I still don't like Trevor Brooking, you know.
Well, it's unbelievable. It's probably the only header he's ever scored in his life. Yeah. You know, because, but I, leading up to that game, if you talk about the Man United game very briefly, if you look at the end of the film of that game, that was the year before I'd done my cruise ship.
But you're on the bench, isn't
that's
there? A picture
right.
of you in, yeah, the, in the suit wearing...
That's right, in the suit. And that was me. That was the... You asked me about the highlights and lowlights of my career. That would have been the lowest point because I'd been injured for 6-7 months with my knee.
Yeah.
And I've missed out on that opportunity to be involved in that. And I was sitting directly behind Terry Neal. And when we scored the winner, Alan Sunderland, all the footages of Terry turns to me and the two of us were just so ecstatic. We threw our arms around each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we just grabbed each other. We didn't know what to say. It was just because, again...
I don't think anybody did.
Those 3 minutes were just surreal. And it was, for me, it was an unbelievable feeling of I could be playing, but it doesn't matter. We've won the cup.
Yeah.
And then again, to come back from that injury and a year later, just to be out there. And thank God my father was at the game as well. I'll never forget it. After the song, I looked up and I said, this is amazing. And I got a wave. So that was a very, very special moment for me.
Yeah.
So the downside, obviously, then was, I think if you look at the league season we had, we played about 70 games. And there was only one substitute allowed in those days, the number 12.
Yeah.
So we would have all played on average about 50 games. Some guys 56, 58, some 47. They it wouldn't be heard of today.
Yeah.
And we played those four really Trojan games against Liverpool
in
the semi-finals. Yeah. And then we had Juventus in the semi-finals. So leading up to the FA Cup final, we were playing up until the week before in another semi-final.
Yeah.
So I'm not making excuses, but the lads were burnt.
Right.
We didn't perform on the day. We didn't play well. They weren't great. And it was a horrible goal. But so it was a really disappointing low point. And then to go away to Europe on the Wednesday then.
Yeah.
But I think it showed. I think fatigue showed.
Yeah.
On that day. We were looking around the dressing room afterwards and we knew we'd another cup final on the Wednesday. The lads had no legs because of all those games. Yeah. You know?
And it came close as well against Valencia,
penalties,
didn't it?
You know? Another sickener, yeah.
It does, yeah. I mean, as a young supporter, it kind of educates you to the highs and lows of the game very quickly, you know?
Oh, absolutely.
You go into these games expecting to win, certainly against West Ham. Yeah. You don't, and then, you know... Yeah.
It was a mixed emotions is exactly right. You know, you're saying, I'm playing at Wembley, but we lost. I'm at Wembley, I didn't play, but we've won. So I've had great experiences of Wembley Stadium and playing for and Ireland against England there as well. So it's a fantastic stadium, like Highbury. It has that magic. And later on, when I had to finish playing my career at 26,
yeah.
The good part of that was, that kept me sane, was you've got an FA Cup final medal, you've got a European Cup Winners' Cup final medal, you've played in the Community Shield.
Yeah.
And I went to Norwich afterwards and we won the cup at Wembley. So I've great memories there, so yeah. I can only say it's been good yeah. most of the time.
So how did it come to a close at Arsenal? What, about 160 odd appearances? And
yeah, and the thing was, I think
Norwich
what happened
then,
was,
it?
I think if you when you realise that we'd been to four cup finals, the three FA Cup finals and a European Cup, and we toured in the league, we had a great team, and we were just so close to Liverpool. But let me tell you, Liverpool in the 70s were playing European football at its highest level.
Yeah,
they had a team that were playing push and move, pass and move, way before anybody else. There was nobody going to touch them at that time. So we were unfortunate. We had a good team, but they had a better team at that time.
Mm.
And Arsenal probably realised they needed to change things. When you've had 7 or 8 Irishmen in a team for that long and highly successful, they obviously got impressions upstairs that maybe it's time to maybe move a few on. And then the wages was coming into play as well, where other teams were on much bigger wages than Arsenal at the time.
Yeah.
And we didn't give a damn. We were playing for the love of it. I would have played for Arsenal for nothing at that time. And Liam Brady was the one who was being offered to go to Juventus. And
yeah.
I think that's where it really started all that. And it had nothing to... Liam Brady was devastated that he had to go to Juventus. He wanted to stay with Arsenal for his whole career. And it was probably the difference between £500 and £1,000 would have been the difference. And I think most of the Arsenal players in that dressing room, when we had meetings about it, would have said, we'll stay on the same contracts for 2 years as long as he can stay, if he wants to stay. He was in tears nearly. Yeah. And he had to go. And I think that was the start of the end for the Arsenal Irish Brigade.
Yeah.
And
obviously it had a big impact on the team as well, because just what a player he was.
Massive player. He was huge, huge. I mean, people often ask me, who was the best player you ever played with?
Yeah.
Liam Brady, without a doubt. I played with Alan Hudson, some fantastic players, Dave O'Leary. I can mention lots of players. Pat Jennings, the best goalkeeper in the world as far as I'm concerned. But Liam Brady, all I had to do, as I say to my friends, was chip the winger into the stand and give Liam the ball.
Yeah.
And just watch. And all I did was just stand behind in amazement sometimes, just to go and support him. You'd never get it back because Liam would beat two or three.
Yeah.
Defence-splitting pass. Liam Brady was probably the best player I've ever seen. And so he was fantastic. So when he left, not only did it affect me as a fullback, it affected other people in the team, I'm sure. And then Frank. And then it started to drift. And then that was that transition period, which every club knows takes a couple of seasons.
Yeah.
And we're starting to break up the team, get new blood in.
Yeah.
And then it was my turn to go, along with a few others like Frank. Yeah. And lots of people left at that time.
And obviously the 80s weren't particularly good for Arsenal. Until George Graham took over and changed things around.
Really, and it took that three or four or 5 years to do that. We knew that was coming as well, but I don't care what people say, to leave a club like Arsenal is a huge dent. You know, from boyhood, from 13 years of age, from arriving there till that time I left, it was a dream. There was ups and downs, highs and lows, but it's a fantastic, and it's only when you leave Arsenal you realise as well how great it is.
Yeah.
The staff, the people there, I mentioned a few, Alfields, all the old guys, Bert Owen, all the staff in the background, Tony Donnelly. It was fantastic. Yeah. You know?
And do you still have a connection with the club?
Well, I've met Liam on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
I think he comes over here now with the junior lads for the St. Kevin's tournament, and I meet up with him and we have a cup of tea there. It's fantastic to get together with him. I haven't been back and forward to the stadium much.
Yeah.
And but I do meet up with Liam on occasions. Frank, I wouldn't see, or Dave. Unfortunately, that's football. You know, people go their own way in life and they move on.
Yeah.
And, you know, you bump into each other occasionally at functions and things. But in general, it'd be Liam I'd bump into. And it's great because, as I said, he was like an idol to me.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Brilliant to play with.
Just give him the ball and let him get on.
Yeah. So your career finished at 26.
Injury, yeah. I'd unfortunately broken my leg when I was younger as well. So I'd had a couple of bad injuries with that cruciate ligament. And then when I was at Stoke, I went to Norwich straight after Arsenal for two seasons.
Yeah.
And had great time there. My daughter was born there, Natasha. And we got to the cup final, which has been commemorated 30 years in March.
Right.
So I'm going over there for that. We've been invited over to get the team to get Mick Shannon, Asa Harf, all those boys, Steve Bruce, Dave Watson, Chris Woods. So it was a good little team under Ken Brown and Mel Machen. And we'll go back to that function and have a look at that. So I played at Wembley. We got the cup final again. We won, which was great to get the winner's medal. And then I went to Stoke. And after 15 games playing for Stoke, and I was having a great time there as well. Terry Conroy was the influence there to get me up there.
Mm.
My ex-assistant manager for Ireland asked me, Alan Hudson was retiring, and he asked me to go up and play a few games in midfield for Mick Mills. And I got on great. We flew up the table, three or four signings, and we done really well, just gelled.
Mm.
And against Brighton away of that year, after 15 games, I had a compound fracture, seven places. The leg was gone. And I knew the minute it happened, it was over. Never be
compact. That's bone sticking out.
That's ankle at a right angle to your knee.
What,
you know,
a bad tackle, was it?
Yeah, it was a bad tackle, and no hardship with the guy. You know, Eric Young. I haven't spoke to him since. That was the game in those days. Was tough.
Yeah.
And there was tackles allowed, and that's where I think the modern game has changed. But Eric, you know, good luck to him. You know, it's nothing to do with that. That was the way it was. It was a tough business, you or him, and that was the way it was in those days. And tackles,
split second stuff, though, wasn't it?
That's the difference. It was over and done, and then you realise then after a couple of operations, the doc say you're not, because of you had the same knee injury, and the same leg. So unfortunately, I had to finish, but luckily with great memories.
Yeah. And did you always, have an inclination to stay in the game? Because we're sitting here in this complex here in Dublin, which is amazing.
Yes.
And obviously you've coached, and you're now involved in this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, did you go straight into that side of things?
Or? No. Well, luckily with Don Howe was a great coach. Don Howe, what a genius he was tactically.
Yeah.
And he had a great influence on me because he taught me a lot about discipline, and he actually encouraged two or three lads, Steve Walford, Alan Sullivan, and I think myself. We went on the coaching badges, and I was about 19 at the time, so I would have got my first badge, and it was Bobby Robson was the main person looking after things.
Cool.
So what a fantastic experience that was when you look back on it. So Don was very influential about how he read the game, his tactical awareness. So I got involved at a young age. So luckily, as I went along, I got more and more badges. I'm now a pro licensed coach, and I've been on UEFA study groups. And for my sins, Alex Ferguson got me on board and asked me to be tech academy director for Ireland for 10 years. So I got involved with that. I couldn't refuse that. It was to work with the best manager. And I have to say, the best manager I've ever known, to be honest. Incredible man. And I worked for Man United for 10 years, a pro license, and I'm currently on the FEI Technical Committee for the National Development Plan to develop the game for future generations. So I'm involved in player development.
And you spoke about how there's a need to be more technical because, you know, I know it's not really comparable, but I can remember that when I was a young guy playing at a reasonably organized level, it was all about physicality and how much you could run and how strong you were, and there wasn't a great deal of technical coaching. Is that changing now in Ireland? Is that something that's going
to... Well, I'm trying to change it. I'm doing the best I can to try and educate people and influence them, because I've travelled extensively. After I finished playing, I went to Norway, I went to India, I went to Africa, I studied all around Holland and Scandinavia, and it was my passion was to the player development. What are the best teams doing? I travelled extensively to Spain, and I come back and got involved. And as I said, I'm on the technical committee now, so hopefully they listen to some of the recommendations that I have. And I think it's for the future. Technically, if I'll give you one example. When I came back on a flight from Manchester after playing for Arsenal against Man United, the Liverpool lads were on the same flight because we were coming back to play for Ireland.
Yeah.
There was 11 players on that flight that started for Ireland the following Wednesday, that played for Man United, Liverpool and Arsenal.
Yeah.
The whole team was made up of top now, and we were first, second and third in the league. Liverpool were first, Man United were second, Arsenal were third. So the top team in the Premier of that time contained 11 players on that flight that played for their country. We haven't got one that are playing really in the top levels coming through the systems anymore. So Martin O'Neill and Roy are talking about the fact that they've nothing coming through. Robbie Keane mentioned it again. It's because we're not developing players correctly. We're playing highly competitive games, and we're putting the cart before the horse, and we need to get back to the fundamentals of skills and, you know, passing, control and dribbling.
It's interesting because I think Arsene Wenger talks about how the formative years of a player's career are quite young, that they reach a point where it becomes not impossible but difficult to improve them technically. In terms of their skills. So if we're still exporting young players to the UK, and there's loads of them going over and maybe not going to the top clubs, is it these years that you guys have got to concentrate on, so that between the ages of 10 and 14, 15 when they go over, that's when this kind of coaching has to make an impact that will then allow them to progress better at the clubs that they go to, or maybe make the leap to bigger clubs?
Absolutely. Arsene Wenger has a great statement when he talks about building a player foundation. He said, if you build a house, you start with the foundations.
Yeah.
We've gone away from that in Ireland, and we're starting on the roof because we want to be highly competitive. They haven't got the basics, technical skills and tactical astuteness and awareness that the continental players have. Subsequently, players are going in droves to England, to lesser clubs, not at the higher levels which I mentioned, Man United, Liverpool, Arsenal, and are coming back equally as quickly because they're just not good enough.
Yeah.
We need to change that dramatically, and the time is... Trevor Brooking was commented recently on in an article. He said, I learned most of what I know about football from 7 to 10. So that tells you something of a player of his esteem. Yeah. Now, I'd agree with him. So I designed a 10-year training programme, but the main fundamental part from 6 to 10 years of age is the most important key point.
Yeah.
And again, I'm trying to influence the FEI and people to get on board, because I know what I'm talking about. I've travelled extensively. I've been with the best. We need to get back to those kids and teach them, and then they can go to the higher clubs, I do believe.
And
great talent in Ireland, by the way. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah, sure.
We have fantastic players in Ireland, raw materials, but we're not teaching them the right way.
Yeah. I mean, I remember at 10, 11 years of age playing 11-a-side football on full-size pitches. It's not really the way to do it, is it?
No. Well, again, the programme I designed is all about two. As I mentioned when I first started this interview, 1v1, 2v2, 3v3, on the street.
Yeah.
Until your mates came around and played. So you had lots of contact with the ball. We know we've talked about things of 10,000 hours of contact with the ball to be an elite player. Mm. That's not happening anymore. Kids don't practice on the street. They're on computers all the time. So I designed these games specifically to make sure the small areas with more touches of the ball, more contact with the ball, and that's what I'm trying to influence, non-competitive football in this country, so that we give them a chance that when they go away, they'll have had those contact hours with the ball.
Yeah. Brilliant.
And that's it. And then, and I know it works. And I've seen Anthony Stokes. When I ran the United Academy, you had Anthony Stokes, who came through the Arsenal system.
Yeah.
He would have played 3v3 and 4v4 at me at 10 years of age. And I know it works.
Yeah.
So hopefully we can take that. The fundamentals need to be addressed really quickly.
Yeah.
And hopefully then Ireland will benefit, because down the line then we can start looking at our 17s and 21s qualifying for things like they did before.
Yeah.
And the first team especially then playing a different brand of football in the future.
Is it more difficult for young Irish kids going over to the UK now, because it's more open? Obviously, when you went over, there weren't the amount of players coming from continental Europe, for example.
It's a great question, and it's a great debate, but I'll give you some quick examples.
Yeah.
I would not say it's more, you know, difficult. It's highly difficult. At the standard is incredible anyway. But if you look at Wales have 3 million. They have 11 or 12 players I could name now that play in the Welsh team that are all currently playing Premier football from the ages of 18 to 24. You can name a whole thing. And that they have rugby league and they've got rugby union. So people sometimes argue, debate, it's Gaelic and rugby here and Hurling.
You know,
that's the example I give. It's 4.5 million in Ireland, 3 million in Wales. They can still produce a Welsh international team and a youth team, and that because they've got a basic training program for 10 years that they're adhering to, and they're going to be way ahead of us unless we play catch up. So I don't agree with this argument, because this continental players, of course, it's going to influence to some degree, but it doesn't stop us doing the right thing. I still believe that we have the quality here to be equally as good as them if we're coached the right way.
Right. It's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge, but it can be done.
Yeah.
And I have no doubts I could do it.
All right.
I have no doubts we can do it. I have no doubts in another few years we could get a 15s and a 17s team back on track with the likes of the Continentals. No problem.
All right. Just finally, before we wrap it up, because I don't want to take up too much of your time.
Right.
What do you make of Arsenal this season? They seem to have found a little bit of form recently, but the early part of the season wasn't quite as good as it should have been, based on what happened last season, having won the cup again after so long without a trophy. I mean, how much do you keep up with what's going on?
Listen, from the day I finished playing for Arsenal, I've looked every Saturday at the results straight away. Arsenal becomes a part of your blood. When you leave home and leave your family to go to a club like Arsenal with such prestige and history, you know, it doesn't leave you.
Yeah.
So as soon as the game, half time or the end, how did they get on? The teams you've played for, especially Norwich and Stoke, I still keep an eye out for them. But Arsenal has a special place in my heart. I think the Manchester City game was the catalyst for Arsenal to become winners again. I know Arsene Wenger is fantastic. They've been playing this fantastic football over the years. I've kept in touch with it. But a lot of it was a little tip-tapping around the box. There's no end product.
Mm.
But more importantly, the defensive side of thing was gone. For me, they grew up tactically. And if you want to win things, that's the way you go about it.
Yeah.
If they can build on that, which they've done in the last 3 or 4 games, they've been fantastic and solid defensively. Now, Steve Boulder's there, who I played with at Stoke.
Oh, wow, that's
yeah,
cool.
Absolutely. Steve was playing centre-back at Stoke, and then he went right-back, and then he went centre-back again. And I actually mentioned it to Arsenal about Steve and Lee Dixon at the time when they were playing, to David Miles, because I thought they had great potential.
Very interesting.
So there you go. So there was a little bit of a connection. And I do see Boldy quite a bit when I'm back in Stoke because we play together.
What's he like as a character? Because when we see him beside Arsene Wenger on the bench, he's normally pretty quiet and he just sort of watches. But I'm guessing, obviously, as a coach and as somebody on the training ground, he's got to be different than that.
Oh, well, he has a presence about him. He's a winner. That's fun. The one thing I noticed about Steve Bould when I played with him, this guy can play at a higher level, and that's why I recommended him, and I'm sure many other people did as well. I'm not saying I was responsible for him going to Arsenal, but I did ring David Miles about him and Lee. He has a quiet strength about him. He knows the game. He wants to win, and he's a really intelligent character, and I think he's a really good top coach for the future. But I think, having learned to watch that game again, Man City for me was the catalyst for Wenger and Bold and the players to realise we might need to do this. We can't be playing this fantastic constructive attacking, you know, counter-attacking football all the time and leaving holes at the back.
Yeah.
They've closed that up. If they can keep that going, they're going to be title contenders, let me tell you now.
All right. Well, fingers crossed. I hope that's the case.
Absolutely. I have no doubts. I think they showed on that day that discipline is needed to win league.
That's the blueprint,
isn't
it?
That's the blueprint, absolutely. It doesn't mean you're negative. It means, you know, you can that count. Look at Walcott's back now. They've got Ozil starting to show a bit more form. You know, the Sanchez, he's got so many quality. Oxley Chamberlain, look at him, that young kid. So many exciting players that can be there in 2 seconds. They're up the other end. But if you get the defensive side done, it can be really exciting to watch for the future. And I can't say enough about them if they can learn from that.
Well, let's hope they do.
Well, let's hope they do. And I'd just like to say one last thing again for anybody listening in from the Arsenal. I'd just like to thank them all. From the time I was 13 years of age, Fred Street, Al Fields, Bert Owen, Tony Donnelly, all those guys in behind the scenes, and now David Miles, Ken Fryer, all those people that were involved in the Dr. Sash, Dr. Crane, I remember them all.
Yeah.
Fantastic people. They made my life an absolute joy for about 9 years to be at Arsenal. To have a play for a club like that with that history is phenomenal. So thanks a lot.
Well, they do say, isn't it, that there's something, just that little bit of class about the way Arsenal do things, and well, here's proof positive.
I'll finish on that word, class.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
My thanks indeed to John Devine for giving me so much of his time. And before we started the interview the other day, he showed me some bits and pieces from his time at the club, some memorabilia that he had saved. And one of those was his first contract on a huge wage. And you can see that it was signed by John, by John's father, and also by Ken Fryer, who, as we know, is still there, Mr. F, doing his thing. There's also some team pictures. There's a team sheet lineup from the FA Youth Cup, I think, from 1974 or 1975. And some of the names on there you'll recognize very quickly indeed. So do check them out. I'm going to put them on the blog post today. So you'll find them, links to them on the blog post. And really interesting to see those bits and pieces. And after we'd finished the interview, John gave me a ring just because he wanted to mention somebody specifically that he forgot to mention at the end there, and that was one of the youth coaches called Roger Thompson, who was not only a great coach and helped him enormously in his football, but also as a man who helped him as a young guy settle into life in London when he was feeling homesick. He was there to make things a bit better, and he said he was one of the main reasons why he stayed at Arsenal when things got a bit tough. So there you go, Roger Thompson. If you're listening, or if somebody knows Roger Thompson, you could pass on the message that John thinks extremely highly of him, and is very grateful for all the kindness that he showed him in his time at the club. So, time to move on, and we've got a North London derby coming up tomorrow. Early kickoff away from home. This was last season's nightmare, wasn't it? But the form we're in and the kind of football we're playing at the moment, it's hard not to be reasonably confident, even though, as the old cliche goes, form goes out the window in these games. And I don't think that's ever more true than when it comes to a North London derby. Form, quality of the teams, none of it really matters, because on the day it's just down to whichever team is going to put in the biggest shift, I think. The team news, such as it is that Alexis is not going to be fit, which is a bit of a shame. That's a blow, because obviously on Monday's Arsecast, we were talking about who would come out of the team to bring Alexis back in. The consensus, well, myself and James had decided that Theo Walcott would probably be the one to make way, but with Alexis out now, I don't think there's going to be any changes to the team at all. The team that played so well against Aston Villa and won 5-0. So it's another chance for Ozil, another chance for Theo Walcott. Olivier Giroud will probably continue up front. However, Danny Welbeck is back, so maybe you could see the manager use him. Not sure. I think he'll probably be on the bench. But the rest of it, well, you wouldn't change much of it, would you, at all, after how well we played against Aston Villa. It's very difficult to know what to say about this game and what to say about a North London derby in particular, other than you just want Arsenal to go out and do their best and smash them around the park and score lots of goals. But it's rare that that happens, particularly at their place. Obviously, they're in reasonable form. I think there's only, 2 points between us in the table? I can't really remember, but it's not much. I know that we moved above them. I'm going to go have a look now. I know we moved above them when we won at the weekend. The Premier League table, as it stands, we're in fifth on 42. They're in sixth on 40. So a draw would keep us ahead of them. A win would put a little bit of distance between us and them, and that would be very nice indeed. I don't know what else to say about it other than I hope the absence of Alexis is about as relevant as it was against Aston Villa. But then, of course, we have midweek action in the Premier League against Leicester City at home. The Leicester game away, one of those we probably should have won but dropped silly points in. You'd be looking for all three, obviously, given the state that they're in, the way that they're playing. They're bottom of the table. They may not be bottom by the time we play them, but who knows? It's still a game that you would expect us to win. So if all things go well between now and Tuesday or Wednesday, we could have added 6 points to our total, which would be very nice indeed going into whatever fixture we have next weekend, which I'm not going to look forward to at this point. So we'll look back on the North London Derby on Monday. Myself and James will be here for an Arscast Extra, hopefully at the correct time. I think he's back from all his world travelling and all that. So we should be back to normal time before lunch on Monday. We'll have the Arscast Extra. So until then, let's keep everything crossed for tomorrow, and we'll chat to you on next week's Arscast. So until then, cheers, bye-bye.
I was sitting staring out the window, admiring the legs of the girl across the road. They were like a giraffe's, long and slender, and with weird clumping hooves at the bottom. The guy walked in. "What do you want, mister?" I said. "I'm busy." "I got a problem," he said. "Oh yeah," I said. "What's that?" "One of my guys, I think he's gone off the rails," he said. "How do you mean?" I said. "You know," he said, "he likes to get baked." "What's the problem with that?" I said. "Who doesn't like delicious snacks straight from the oven?" "No," he said, "he goes out every day at 4:20. "So he's punctual and reliable," I said. "What's the problem?" "Oh my God," he said, "he likes to get high." "Oh, you should have said that in the first place." So I followed the kid. The next week I reported back to the man. "Your guy doesn't have a problem with that, don't worry." "Oh," he said, "that's such a relief." "Sure," I said, "but he just sold his car for opium."
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.